I like the intentionality mm-hmm. of listening to records.
Yeah.
It does require physical action. You do have to flip it. You do have to clean it. When you want to have the experience and you have your original 1966 pressing of Blonde on Blonde, you're going to play Blonde on Blonde all the way through because that's the way you do it. It's just good taste. It's good manners.
I love that. It's just good taste. Like, it's just what you do.
It's just what you do.
Yeah. Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week we've got three different segments recorded in three different cities across the United States. The main event is my conversation with Patrick Godfrey, who's one of the co-CEOs of Godfrey Dadich Partners. You may remember that name because in an early episode of Hodinkee Radio, I spoke to Scott Dadich, his co-CEO. Patrick's a super smart guy and one of those people who finds something and goes really deep. So we talk about vintage Rolex, we talk about Italian wines, and we even make a couple of record recommendations. It was a fun conversation, and I think we're probably going to have him back on soon. On the back end of the show, we've got Cara and Jack doing something that we're calling the Rorjack test, sort of like a Rorschach test. Instead of ink blots, Jack is pulling sheets of paper out of a hat with words written on them, and Cara has to say the first thing that comes to mind. It's fun, it's goofy, give it a listen. But first, in Los Angeles, James and I thought it'd be a nice idea to sit down and talk about the movies. So we decided to take the iconic era of the 1960s and 70s and pick sort of five iconic movies with five iconic watch placements and talk about why we love the watches, why we love the movies, and why we think they're such great pairings. So without further ado, here we go. This week's episode is presented by Grand Seiko. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at one of the four watches from the new Seasons collection, which is exclusive to the U.S. For more, visit GrandSeiko.com. All right, where are we?
L.A., baby.
L.A., baby. We're sitting in a hotel room, which is why there might be a slight echo, occasional noise in the hallway. But we're sitting in an LA hotel room the day before an event we're doing with Brunello Cucinelli.
Yep.
And we figured we're in LA. Time to record a movie pod?
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I'm at this point, I'm kind of used to it. I recorded one for TGN just a couple days ago. Certainly by the time this goes up, that episode will be up. So that's like the third installment of our film club.
Yeah, yeah. So you do this film club thing from time to time. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's just like one of these reoccurring topics that we picked up. But with the film club, we wanted to have a chance to talk movies occasionally, but like not at any like intensely deep level, just to have a few minutes to talk about a movie we liked. So we made this thing where, you know, your goal for the main topic of the episode is like 35 to 40 minutes probably of talking.
Yeah.
30 minutes, certainly. So then we just said, well, like if we each pick five movies and we each have, say, 3 to 4 minutes to talk about them.
Yeah.
Then we end up with, you know, 10 movies in an episode every time we do a film club. So we get 10 new movies. And yeah, so it didn't work out quite that way because this latest episode is like an hour and 50 minutes long.
Okay.
But outside of that, you know, we'll call it a sizable setback. The concept is simple. It's just movies that we like.
So which from the latest film club, what are some of your favorite movies?
From the latest, I mean, there's actually at least one that's on the list of movie watches that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
And then for me, like, you know, the really recent stuff from Denis Villeneuve, Sicario, Blade Runner 2049, these are all really great. And then one of my most favorite movies that I've seen in the recent history is just Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. So, yeah. I mean, that's 1948. Yeah. It's this incredible story.
Yeah.
I don't know. If you want to hear more about it, I just, you know, download TGN 92, which is the... Film Club Volume 3.
For Rope, people can download the last episode of Hodinkee Radio where we talked about it with Eric Koo.
Oh, true enough. Yeah, we did. Yeah. Great movie.
So the conceit for today is a little different. We're gonna do something a little bit more structured. We figured we're in LA. We should do something movie related. So we kept coming back to these like iconic movies of the 60s and 70s, right? Like anytime we tried to figure out a topic, those seemed to be the movies we kept coming back to.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, whenever like if you want to, you were in Hollywood, we maybe want to talk about movies or use that as like an impetus to talk about movies. I mean, it's always nice to kind of consider the golden era, which is where we like established a lot of like the way movies look today, the way they sound today, the way that product integration is done today is all just an evolution of what was established. It's definitely in the era of color movies, the 60s into the 70s.
Right. And there's a funny thing where that time period happens to overlap with what we would consider like the golden era of the mechanical watch, right? Like in the same way that we keep coming back to these sort of like iconic movies and iconic movie franchises, it's the same way that like collectors keep coming back to the Speedmaster and to the Carrera and to the Submariner,
It's for sure.
That era is sort of a perfect bridge between the two worlds.
Yeah, I mean, largely these are a lot of topics. You could throw cars in there too that flourished following World War II. You had this kind of rapid development of technology and engineering throughout the war that was then applied into other industries. So you had this explosion in growth with cars, with watches, with films. And then by the 60s, they started to hit their stride and the technical elements were so locked in that we started to see huge advancements in style and directorial sort of work and camera work and things like that. And then 70s, I mean, as we'll see with films, certainly with watches, things just keep progressing towards, further and further evolution and more market appeal.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So we decided we would look at that era. So 60s and 70s. And we wanted to we thought a good place to start wouldn't be some obscure thing like the watches you'd never seen or, kind of digging. We thought it'd be nice to highlight what might be the five most iconic watch placements of the 60s and 70s, if not the five of the most significant.
Yeah, I'd say these all deserve at least the argument that they should be on this list. It's a tough one because you start to apply like people's taste in films.
Totally.
And then even in the very first example we have, we actually have a huge change in context between when this watch was connected with that character and who that character is connected with now.
Yeah. So let's jump right into it then. I mean, that's a perfect reason to go into it. The first movie we wanted to talk about, we're going to go in chronological order, and this is sort of like the watch guy movie, right? 1962, it's Dr. No, the very first James Bond movie.
Mm-hmm. So, and now we're seeing Bond 25. It's been this hugely successful, long-running campaign and series of films. And with that, each one of them kind of had to evolve with the time around them, whether it's tone, which obviously has changed a lot since Dr. No.
Yeah, just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, to aesthetics, to things like cars and watches and the way people dress. And all of that has to kind of like, Bond always suits the time when that movie came out. They don't shoot a Bond movie in a period structure, which is a really fun idea. Keep a note of that. That sounds like fun. But, outside of that, I mean, because they're not period pieces, the watches and stuff change. But if you catch the right time, you end up with a really killer watch.
Yeah, right. And so the watch in that movie is the 6538 Rolex Submariner. The big crown, the James Bond sub now, it's in many ways like the perfect watch and the perfect character to go together like that right off the bat. I mean, that's coming in pretty hot.
Yeah, and it would speak to Bond's history in various levels of the British military system and certainly on his route to MI6. And I think, it's on a NATO that he lights a lighter to be able to check the time. And it's this
just
like locked in. We are seeing this watch. And it's like obviously today we associate heavily Bond with Omega very successfully, especially, since the Pierce Brosnan days. I would say maybe they predated the watch into Timothy Dalton. I don't remember that well. The Timothy Dalton ones,
I don't think so,
aren't highest on my watching list. but we now obviously attribute a whole line or look within the Seamaster as the Bond. Officially or unofficially, certainly, and then beyond that, it's a very official partnership between Omega and the James Bond franchise, and one that's longstanding, and certainly sells a ton of watches for them. I mean, it would be up there with their connections to the Olympics, and
I'm sure,
and that sort of thing. And you have to, I don't know, you can never really quite tell what Rolex is thinking, but you got to think every now and then when another Bond movie comes out, they must kick themselves a little bit. that, you know, they were in no probably a very organic sort of appearance of the correct sort of watch that Bond would have been wearing.
Yeah.
And now applied to an entirely different franchise and brand, and what has proven to be a very flexible platform for kind of defining style and ruggedness. Yeah. And, you know, Bond has this caddish quality to him that they're fading out, obviously, with the times. But beyond that, it really is kind of an archetype of Western manliness. You know, we're post cowboy now. We're even kind of post like Terminator and the kind of predator giant muscle sort of thing. And you're into James Bond just kind of returns as this mix of like a do-it-all dangerous guy that also wears nice suits and drives nice cars. And it's a powerful thing. And I think it's interesting where they started and where they are now.
Yeah, agreed.
Also just a good looking watch.
Yeah, it's a hell of a watch. And we were talking when we were prepping for this, there's sort of a bit of misinformation that came from the appearance of this watch, right? So you mentioned the NATO on this watch, and it's, first of all, it's 18 millimeters and it should be 20. So it doesn't really fit the watch right.
It's kind of a distinctive look. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And it's a little bit more like laissez-faire. Like if this was something you were given by your government or your employer,
totally.
You might not be nerd level picking your strap.
Right.
Your,
and I believe the original, the mil subs, the Rolex mil subs were delivered on 18 millimeter straps.
I mean, they were certainly delivered on NATOs because they would have been, welded spring bars.
Right. Right. But so I think they were delivered on narrow, NATOs, but beyond the size of the NATO, for years, people used to call a black NATO with gray stripes a James Bond NATO, right? But it turns out that isn't actually the NATO he's wearing in the movie. He's wearing one that's black with red and green stripes, but those red and green stripes don't resolve enough.
Yeah, there's not a ton of color left in the film, yeah.
Yeah, and so when people would watch old prints of this movie, it looked like it was just two gray stripes when it was actually this like very complex pattern of green and red. And only with restoring the film did the sort of like watch scholarship catch up in the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's a fun look, I think. And those royal military style NATOs are popular and you see people.
For sure.
And you'll still always see people wearing the black with the gray stripes, which is also a solid look.
Still cool.
Hard to go wrong. Really, it's hard to go wrong with any sub on a NATO. It's just it's a killer look. And it does kind of speak to that like mix of, you know, kind of overdeveloped ruggedness / kind of classic in some ways, kind of a nonchalance to the whole idea that this is a luxury product.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So movie number two is Le Mans from 1972. Famously, that's where Steve McQueen wore the Monaco.
So this is where basically the Monaco made its big debut into a wider audience. The watch had been around since 1969. It wasn't exactly their most popular model. You know, it was meant to slot into where Jack Hoyer believed there was a hole in their product lineup between the Octavias and the Carreras. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted something kind of super distinctive. Didn't really look like other stuff, but still sporty. And I think they actually hit the mark on the Monaco with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if the Monaco, in my opinion, doesn't wear as well as an Octavia or a Carrera, they are much more distinctive. And if someone gets out of a race car in a head-to-toe Hoyer blue, white, and red suit and has this blue watch on his wrist, all you need is a little bit of star power behind that, and a bunch of people are going to start to notice that watch. Luckily, they had like the biggest star in the world at the time.
Yeah, being about as cool as he could possibly be.
Yeah, so Steve McQueen is a race car driver, you know, driving this incredible Porsche, and it is just a really, really great portrayal of a race car driver. I don't think the movie's very good. It's kind of weirdly paced. It's not
that
interesting.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's a famous movie. Mm-hmm. It's in some ways sort of like an important movie. I don't think it's a very good movie.
I don't think there's a lot of like story merit to it.
Yeah, agreed.
I think that,
and
you
even
know,
the
visually
filmmaking
it's pretty
is
fantastic.
Like, the racing is great. The rest of the filmmaking is like okay.
Yeah. It's a period.
Yeah, it's fine.
A mid space.
Yeah, it's
Steve
fine.
McQueen. I mean, like people love to go crazy about Bullet.
Right.
Bullet's not a great movie. It's real long. It's real slow. It has a decent car chase in it. We should probably get over all the rest of it.
Right.
Watch The French Connection and then talk to me about car chases.
Agreed. Yeah.
But when we're looking at this movie, you know, at Le Mans, the other thing that I was told when I was on a press trip with Tag Heuer to Monaco earlier this year, and the thing they were telling us about the Monaco specifically is the reason that it ended up in Le Mans was because that's what they had some available. They didn't have Crayers. They didn't have Octavias to send to the film studio. So when they requested some watches, and this number I might get wrong, they sent either 3 or 10.
I think it was 10.
For the filming. And it was a watch that like wasn't crazy popular at the time. And it wasn't necessarily even like a like what might have been considered a great marketing move for Jack Hoyer to send those watches then. It's more of that's what they had.
Yeah.
And the right person requested, you know, this production person requested Hoyer's for, you know, for realism within the sphere of this Le Mans film. And that's what they sent them. And it literally means that we have a Monaco today.
Right.
Because otherwise you could make the case that like, imagine if the Royal Oak never took off, they would have stopped making it after a couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, they would have done the same thing with the Monaco. If it wasn't in this movie in 1971 and didn't kind of become a standout in a very stylish time that was right on the edge of that sort of retro look that we now aspire or that we now attribute to the 70s, that look didn't really happen in 71. It happened in 74 or 75. So, you know, it's the end of the decade that defines typically the look of the decade because you're carrying over from the 60s. And with these watches, if it didn't have that running start in 1971 by being in a huge McQueen film, you know, you could at least make the claim accurate or otherwise that there's the Monaco might not be around. They might not be celebrating 50 years this year.
Right. And celebrating it with what looks rather successfully, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I think it seems to be going just fine.
So watch number three, movie number three.
Yeah.
We're going to get a little more obscure with our watches, if not with our movies. We're going to go to 1975 and Jaws, which I'm going to admit is one of my favorite movies of all time.
I mean, it's a fantastic movie, a less than fantastic book. But a great movie with an awesome set of characters. And then for those of you who've been around the watch identifying subculture that exists on Watch You Seek for years, you'll know that there was one watch that kind of floated between Time Zone and Watch You Seek and these other ones as everybody tried to make a claim to knowing what Richard Dreyfuss's character was wearing.
Cooper.
Correct. What he was wearing in the film. And there was always, you know, these huge threads of trying to figure it out. And then finally somebody did figure out it's this, a watch from a brand called Alsta and it's called the Nautoscaf. And it actually kind of relaunched that brand because somebody bought up the brand's intellectual property and they relaunched the same watch within the last 2 years, certainly, maybe even just last year.
Okay.
Really just a cool watch and on, one of the meat, and on one of the lead roles in what you could argue is the first blockbuster of all time, the first like big summer blockbuster. This is 1975. Everybody had to see Jaws. We still reference the music more than we reference even the fact that it's about a shark. Like, it's a pretty incredible touchstone in filmmaking and a really really great placement by.
It was also Spielberg's first big budget movie, right?
I believe
so. The first time they kind of like let him run with it and spend kind of whatever he had to spend.
Richard Dreyfuss's character is Hooper, by the way.
Hooper. Okay. Hey, Gray, here you have me saying Hooper. Hooper. Cut that out. It's funny how this watch came out of this movie and ended up essentially like relaunching a modern brand. It's kind of a funny, funny, obscure little thing to launch a company on the back of, but like the watch doesn't look half bad.
No, it absolutely doesn't. I think it's quite a nice kind of a twist on like a skin diver.
Yeah, it's got that like thick kind of like monoblock case and a rotating metal bezel. And yeah, it's like, it looks like an early 70s dive watch.
Yeah, and Hooper in the movie is wearing it on this kind of super distinctive bracelet style, like a cuff style bracelet.
Oh, yeah, which is with all the holes in it.
Two curved pieces of metal with like holes drilled out of it. And the new watch is offered, I mean, you can still find those sort of bangle bracelets.
Yeah.
But the new watch is offered on what I think is, looks like a pretty solid little like Milanese mesh, which really kind of locks in its aesthetic.
Yeah, I agree.
But new or old, I remember when people finally figured out what this was online and it kind of like it had this weird following. And I love Jaws. I think this is it's just one of the best movies out there. Certainly a great movie to highlight what they were up to in the 1970s. And the same with kind of the placement of this kind of interesting watch, which my guess is just something they bought at a dive shop.
Yeah, probably.
You know, like a pretty casual brand, not a big name, a pretty simple style. I would say it definitely looks like one of the factory cases that all the brands were using for skin divers. So you could make that leap as well that it, you know, this is a small brand that maybe sat in shelves next to Doxa's and things like that. So
Speaking of Doxa, movie number four, mm-hmm. watch number four, mm-hmm. is the Doxa shark hunter that appears in 1975's 3 Days of the Condor.
Yeah, so another really, really cool movie. This one is not as famous in any way as Jaws.
Yeah.
But has a pretty solid watch placement. So the main character in this film, and this is sort of... this is a mix of like a Jack Ryan-y sort of like analyst has to become more of a spy mm-hmm. scenario where Redford comes back to his office. He works in intelligence, comes back to his office and things aren't quite how he left said office. And he's quickly realizing that he doesn't know who's actually the aggressor and they don't seem to know who's to blame. And it might be him. It might be other people. It's this really fantastic sort of, okay. not so much whodunit as like a man who knew too much / man who knew too little.
Okay.
If you need like a modern, it's not that very similar movie, but if you needed a modern connection, think like a 70s Robert Redford, Enemy of the State.
Okay. Okay.
You know, just a...
Yeah,
a,
I mean, I'll admit I have not seen this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great movie. I think it's a pretty solid Robert Redford performance. And then on top of that, he's wearing this rad Doxa shark hunter on a bund strap that I mean it's just full heating.
Yeah. that's what we call that look. Yeah. For
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. So I think it's a fun placement. It's a movie that I think a lot of people probably haven't seen. It's in our TGN Film Club Volume 3 as it's one
which
of
we'll
one of
we'll link
favorite.
Up in the show notes here.
Super. And yeah, I think that's probably all you have to say about a Wicked Shark Hunter on a cool movie.
Wicked Shark Hunter.
Yep.
All right, last up, kind of finishing the 70s off. We had a movie that the moment we decided to do this, you and I both said, like, this is the movie, like, this is the anchor for this segment, right? Which is Apocalypse Now, 1979, Apocalypse Now. I mean, landmark movie, but also kind of a landmark watch movie.
Yeah, I think so. And one that we're kind of now coming back on, oddly enough, this
yeah.
year.
Well, it's the 40th anniversary this year. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes sense. And then with that, the sort of brands who made these watches and then people who might want to sell them on the secondary market
yeah.
are all kind of like coming out of the woodwork now. Mm-hmm. So it's become kind of a talking point, right?
For sure. I mean, obviously celebrity owned / movie watches are worth quite a lot now. They probably, you know, to some level they always have been, especially but if you're dipping into steel Rolex with a famous actor provenance, we're in the same vein. We're not on the same piece of geological strata, but the same vein,
right?
As the you know the Paul Newman's. So that's yeah. what everyone's chasing, and yeah. certainly the two watches in Apocalypse Now include a now very noteworthy 1675 bezel-less 1675 that's you know hand engraved with Marlon Brando's signature on the case back, and that's going to be sold in December.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the other, I think, equally as cool watch from the movie is Willard's 6105 Seiko Diver.
Yeah.
And
which got a reissue.
Got reissued this
year
at Basel World. Yeah. And I mean, the reissue's rad. The originals are rad. The fact that this is a watch that very well could have actually been on that adventure, not unlike the GMT Master. I mean, this is two of the best watch placements in one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
These aren't layman's selections. These are things that could have been in that place at that yeah. time, worn by those types of people. And the idea of like a fallen high-ranking officer in the military with a beat-up GMT Master in the middle of the jungle, that works. And likewise, the idea of what's essentially a non-successful grunt in the army that's being selected for what's essentially an assassination plot, wearing a Seiko, a big Seiko dive watch, is also just perfect.
Yeah. All right. So it's kind of our first Hodinkee Radio Film Club,
yeah,
I guess.
There you go.
Yeah. We'll call it that for
movies
now.
Movies and watches, watches.
Movies
and
watches. Yeah. I think we're going to have to do this again.
I think it could be fun. I think these are five of, I would say, the easy targets.
Yeah. Agreed.
But hopefully there's a movie or two in there maybe you haven't seen or a watch you didn't realize had kind of started its time as a movie star.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Dr. No, Le Mans, Jaws, 3 Days of the Condor, and Apocalypse Now. It's a handful of good watches.
Yeah, handful of good watches, handful of good movies. And yeah, if you're listening and you have a movie or a watch spotting that you mm-hmm. you think is worth us maybe including in a future episode, let us know in the comments. Hit us up, hodinkee.com, and then let us know in the comments on this post.
Thanks very much for listening.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for doing this, man.
You bet.
Up next, we've got my conversation with Godfrey Dadich Partners co-CEO, Patrick Godfrey.
Hey, good to see you. Thanks for having us here.
Really great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
So we're recording at your offices in the, Soma District of San Francisco?
Yes, in the Soma District on New Montgomery Street.
Perfect. Can you, I have to say, walking into the office, I was pretty impressed. This is a pretty incredible space you guys have here.
This building is remarkable, and we are incredibly lucky to be here. It's actually a famous building. It was the tallest one in San Francisco for 40-some-odd years. It was the Pacific Telephone Building.
Okay.
So it had an interesting history. The Atlantic has written pieces about this building, telling a sort of history of San Francisco through the building.
Oh, cool.
But it's got a remarkable lobby. It's just a really fantastic place. And we were kissing a lot of frogs before our prince showed. So we feel enormously grateful every day that we got into such a cool space.
I got to say, it's amazing. It's cool because you come in through the lobby and it's this sort of old, historic, amazing building. And then you get up here and it's just like, it's so light. You almost get to kind of like exhale a little bit.
It's great. And we get light from all sides. We get views from all sides. We have actual staircases that some of us take down and the really good among us take all the way up to the 17th floor.
I was going to say, we're on the 17th floor here.
We are on the 17th floor, but have to say that 10 of these floors are occupied by Yelp. And they're, if you didn't like the website, wait until you meet the people.
Perfect.
So they can clog an elevator like no one's business. So the stairs turn out to be a real godsend.
Don't add us. If you work for Yelp, please don't. We don't need that.
Yeah, thank you very much. And that was a 1-star review of actual Yelp, and we can get into that later.
Perfect. Yeah, one of the things I noticed is we're recording this in a conference room, and the conference room is named after a typeface, which all of the conference rooms are here.
Yeah, I think it really speaks to who we are as a firm, that every space where you're going to sit and collaborate with anybody is named after a typeface. I thought I knew a thing or two about type until I had gone into partnership with Scott Dadich. And now not only do we name our rooms after typefaces, he can, you'll notice among art directors and designers, the ability to quickly identify typefaces. What I didn't know was possible is there are people who can take a look at a fairly standard and common typeface and see the differences and realize which foundry created which version of which typeface.
Okay.
So that's the level of type nerds we're talking about here.
Okay. And are you now on that level, or are you still like kind of wowed?
No one looks to me for anything when it comes to graphics or style or other. I like to consider myself a highly gifted designer and art director and everything else, but without the talent or the hard work. Honestly, I live in awe of the people I work with, and I benefit from them knowing what they know. So
nice.
It's all osmosis for me.
I mean, that's a pretty good way to build a team, right?
It's a great way to build a team. I mean, I there are a couple things I do well, and then I lean very heavily on, you know, all the energy and enthusiasm and intelligence of people who are much better than me.
Nice. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you guys do here. So we talked a little bit about it when we had Scott on the show last year, but what is Godfrey Dadich Partners?
Yeah, it's an exciting place to be because we're in the vanguard of how marketing and communications and design are working for brands today. Ultimately, what we do is we help brands tell better stories. And we consider stories to be not only important, but we consider them to be actually essential to what it means to be a human being. And advertising certainly has a history of good storytelling done in a certain way. But the advertising industry has changed enormously. Scott and a lot of the people we brought over from Wired come from publishing. And if there's one thing publishing knows well, it's how to tell a good story. But with publishing going through its difficulties and advertising as it existed being really fragmented, you know, with all the channels and choices and places where there are no ads like Netflix and HBO, there's been this massive change. And in that change has been opportunity. And the opportunity is that brands can now tell better stories because they have access to the same tools and to the same artists to tell those stories and not have to do it through the classic models of trying to get a magazine to cover you or trying to get a TV show to do something about you or trying to run advertising. We now have the tools and the platforms as brands and marketers to tell those stories directly. And that's what we do as a firm. And it's great. It's exciting to be, again, in the vanguard of how this stuff is going to look in the future, which is definitely what we're doing.
Okay. And so you come from a slightly more traditional advertising background, but you wouldn't describe what you guys do as being an advertising firm, right?
It would be a misnomer. I would say that about 35% of what we do is advertising.
Okay.
Which is great because advertising is where I came from. Advertising gave me a great life. It taught me skills that I will cherish forever. And when we have an advertising problem in front of us for a client, advertising is the perfect tool. Where you get into trouble is when you start applying advertising to problems that are not advertising problems. Mm. And that's what we have the flexibility to do now. So in our work for Nike, most of our work is documentary films. And our work for organizations like Lyft, we're not doing things for Lyft where we're advertising the service. We're doing things for Lyft where we're doing stories for drivers so they can understand how to be more successful in working with Lyft. Because it's not all evident. There are dozens of examples exactly like that. So our opportunities sometimes for a client like Adyen, big payments processor, they're not known here. They're a Dutch company founded in the Netherlands. They had a real awareness issue here. Well, advertising is a great tool to solve that. But we got into a situation, I did anyway, as long as 10 years ago, where clients were coming to me, and I very much owned an advertising agency at the time. And they'd say, we want you to bring great ideas, but we don't want you to bring any advertising. And about the 10th time you hear that, you have to understand that they're trying to tell you something.
Yeah.
And that's the big pivot that we have spent years pushing on to get to a place where we could be not anti-advertising in any way, but post-advertising in how we see the world.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's, we deal with it on the media / sort of like sponsored content, native content side of things. But, brands are trying to tell stories directly to consumers. And those consumers are savvier than they've ever been about who's telling them what, how they're digesting that stuff, how sort of the kind of interaction between storyteller and the person they're telling the story to, that kind of like point where they meet, I think is really interesting. And it's where all of that kind of like brain power is put into trying to make that connection as seamless as possible. Do you think that with consumers kind of becoming savvier, that those strategies have to be changed at all about how you kind of approach consumers with stories?
I think so. I think that there's so much opportunity though with how you approach those consumers. Some of the tactics that may have seemed anachronistic really recently have become great to tell those stories again. Take magazines, for instance. We're actually in a world where we're watching a lot of great and storied magazines go through their final days, and it's going to accelerate from here, especially if the economy slows down. And that's not fun to watch, right? We're watching a publishing model where these publishers who didn't develop a relationship with the reader so directly that they were monetizing the reader, they were just charging for advertising to get the reader on board. It's going to be a really tough go for those things. But we're also seeing these new niche magazines that go mass niche that are doing amazing things. And I'm not just talking about Hodinkee, but some of the other magazines that really bring new ideas to life. My favorite travel magazine right now is made by a corporation. It's Airbnb Magazine.
Interesting.
And it's because Airbnb Magazine is built around a new breed of traveler and a new way of traveling that it works so well. If you look at all of the magazines that you know about in the travel space, they all back themselves into a corner, talking about Condé Nast Traveler and Travel and Leisure and all those. They were always talking about the gold list. They were always doing the hot list. They were always doing, the top 100. But ultimately, they were serving a demographic that attracted advertising dollars. So they were serving white people of a certain age and a certain income. And they became very self-referential. And then it just became about cruises and then became about resorts where they're charging $1,400 a night. That was always the last line in the review. Double started $1,400 a night. And they got into a place where all of a sudden that audience wasn't really looking to them as much anymore with the internet. And if you read one of those magazines now, it's literally just fabulously expensive resorts and fabulously expensive cruises to all the same places. And then a lot of advertorial. Well, Airbnb Magazine comes out and does a big feature on Cuba. And you'd never see Cuba covered in a real way by one of these magazines because there's no big tourism industry that was being monetized out of the U.S.
Yeah, there's no money to be made directly out of writing about Cuba.
Right. And Airbnb's whole brand is about allowing people to be home in new places. So when Airbnb Magazine, which is produced by Hearst, they're the partner in doing that, they've created a really exciting and interesting magazine, completely unshackled from the economics of where the magazine world came from, because they're doing something that's about experience and about being in new places, which is what travel should be about. And yeah, it's aligned to the needs of the audience, not the septuagenarians who are thinking about taking yet another river cruise down the Danube.
So you're not going on a river cruise anytime soon?
Not septuagenarian yet, but but rapidly sliding into that position.
I think one of the things you kind of touched on, right, is a lot of this opportunity comes from the fact that the old publishing model is dying out.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is sort of a natural transition, or do you think it's something that is going to go through many different kind of phases?
Well, I think it's we're seeing a like an 80-year run come to an end. And that 80-year run that we're seeing come to an end is the concept of making rate base, right? Mm-hmm. Magazines traditionally made all of their money by attracting an audience, turning that audience into a marketable commodity, and then selling advertising. And if it was, you know, Ladies Home Journal, it was a lot of advertising for consumer packaged goods and makeup and other things around the house. And if it was GQ, it was a lot of ads for cars and for clothing and things like that. The challenge, of course, is that rate base isn't how you monetize anymore. There are media that are doing incredibly well by appealing to their readers. The New York Times has over 2 million subscriptions, which is huge. They get more money now from subscribers than advertisers, which is the enormity of that change is huge. And we're seeing a lot of media that are doing just that. We're seeing new media like The Athletic, where, you know, they're taking local sports fandom and charging you a really fair amount to get you to read about your team and pay for it directly. We're seeing paid newsletters. The through line with all of this is, if you want to survive as a publisher, you have to get your readership to pay for your content. Full stop. Because the idea of being able to create this luxury veneer and then having the luxury advertisers pay for that access, it's not going to work anymore. And those publishers that are reliant on ad dollars and rate base for their models, if they haven't balanced it yet around subscribers paying, they're going to end up in a really tough place.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think I would say I agree with everything you've said. And I think watching the transition, you know, we both know a ton of people in the kind of traditional media space.
Yeah.
And watching how people are adapting is super fascinating, not just the companies, but watching how these people with very specialized skill sets who are immensely talented in a lot of cases try to find new ways to make those skills useful and to connect with readers and with an audience is extremely interesting.
Look at mutual friends, and we were talking about them earlier, you know, Matt Hranek and Yolanda Edwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Neither is at Condé anymore, but both have their own magazines. And as we both know, have managed to spend the last 3 months in Europe. So they're doing something right.
Yeah,
and they're doing really nice titles. We, you know, Yolanda doing Yellow and with Matt doing the William Brown Journal. Those are the promising signs of spring for how this thing goes forward. The thing that's less promising is looking at Condé and seeing Golf Digest and wondering what the hell the future of that is.
And now we'll look at this week's sponsor. Now, I'm in no rush for it to be winter yet, but if there was one thing that had me eyeing snowy days ahead, it would be the Grand Seiko SBGA 415, which is the winter watch from the brand's new U.S. exclusive Seasons collection. It's cool, it's crisp, and it's quintessential Grand Seiko. The foundation of the SBGA 415 is a 40mm case made of lightweight titanium with a mix of brushed and polished finishes that give it a ton of visual appeal. Unlike the summer and fall watches in the collection, this watch uses the Caliber 9R65, which is a souped-up spring drive movement with a 72-hour power reserve and an automatic winding system. Looking at the dial, you'll have no doubts that this is the winter watch in the Seasons collection. It's a soft, slightly warm shade of white with a unique pattern and texture that recalls a windswept, snowy landscape. As the blued seconds hand smoothly glides over the top, you can't help but feel a sense of calm and quiet. Grand Seiko approaches watchmaking in a uniquely Japanese way that truly sets the brand apart. and the SBGA 415 Winter is a perfect example of this special poetic style. For more about the Seasons collection and Grand Seiko's other families of watches, visit GrandSeiko.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
So we don't have to talk shop forever, but the one last thing I wanted to touch on here is one of the things that has impressed me about GDP is watching what you guys have been doing and the clients you're working with and the way you work with those clients is I get a real sense that not just you and Scott and the kind of like people in the business, but that the business itself has a perspective. It has a point of view. It has ethics. It has values in who you choose to work with, how you choose to work with them, who you choose to support. That's not an easy thing to do, to run a company and to make it profitable while also kind of like standing for things. Why was that something you guys chose to do? Did it kind of happen organically? What's the kind of genesis of that?
It happened organically at first, and then it became something where we decided to double down on it.
Yeah.
And I think we get a lot of credit for courage around this. And I think it, in retrospect, it was just the obvious right thing to do. One of the ideas that exists in corporate America, as I've watched it for the last three decades of my career, is people want to simplify how audiences react to things. They want to say the world is split in two. You know, there's the good side and the bad side, or is the right and the left. And they want to do everything they can to steer away from ever taking a position and having that position be something where, oh, I don't want to support a progressive cause because some of my customers might be Republicans, or I don't want to support a conservative cause because I don't want to piss off that cohort of my audience that might be liberal. And I think we're seeing lots of examples in the world today where that model just doesn't hold anymore, and there's actually no truth to it. Mm-hmm. Earlier this week, we even saw the Business Roundtable, the most powerful executives in American business, talk about moving away from the Milton Friedman model of the only duty of a corporation is to increase value for shareholders,
yeah,
to this idea of having more stakeholders in the mix. Now, we can get into an argument of whether or not they actually mean that or whether that's just a cynical play to get out of jail free card. But for us, one of the things we learned from our people was that we were saying all the right things in terms of our values, but we weren't always living our values. And that hurt because Scott and I very much believe in the causes that we believe in, diversity, inclusion, you know, across the board. But we found out through some self-examination that we weren't always, even though we felt the right things and we thought we were doing the right things, our actions didn't always live up to our beliefs. Like when we kept hiring white men of a certain age for jobs, our thing is we're always going to hire the most qualified person we meet and talk to. Well, we found out that we weren't meeting people that were just as qualified because we were fishing in familiar waters. So we had to make a conscious choice to fish in less familiar waters. And in so doing, we started meeting these people who were incredibly competent who didn't look like white men of a certain age. I mean, still happily hire white men of a certain age, but now we tend to see more diverse groups of people come through. The other thing we do is that we do a lot of our work for the shop. I mean, we have three criteria for work. Can we do great work, which is the only one that matters? Can we have fun? And can we make money? And we consider a good assignment one where we can say yes to two of those. When you're working for some large corporations, you might not be having any fun, but you're probably doing great work and you're probably making pretty good money. When we're working with the Obama Foundation, we're doing great work, we're having fun, and we're absolutely not making money. And we've done work for Futures Without Violence. We've done work for the ACLU. We've done work with Planned Parenthood. We've hosted fundraisers. These are the values we hold as an organization. They represent the values of the people that we work with. We don't have a litmus test for working here. There are probably people here who either lean Republican or vote Republican. I think embracing diversity means you have to have that be part of what you are as well. But it's important that we live our values. And I've had a lot of friends and peers say, I'm really, you know, you guys are really courageous in doing that. I don't think that's true at all. I think it's actually becoming just smart to do that. You need your people bound to your purpose. You can look at brands that do the same thing as well. I mean, Patagonia has made a series of motions recently to say, if you are not putting the environment front and center of everything you're doing, we actually will not let you buy our product anymore. I absolutely
love
that.
Which is incredible.
I actually love that because everybody wants that puffy vest to be embroidered with the logo so badly. If you're like a private equity firm or an oil and gas company, they'll just tell you to go screw. And the funny part is it just makes those people want those vests more.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah. And it makes everybody who can put their logo on them want to order twice as many.
And we, of course, when we firmed up who we are as a firm, we did our Patagonia vest because why not? It's aligned to our values. Now it feels like we have to do it again because we qualify.
Yeah,
that's
right,
the type of organization that Rose and the team will think that meets their standard. A principled stand is when you give up something meaningful because of your beliefs. Like I could boycott Walmart and it would be a hollow gesture because I'm not about to step foot in a Walmart. Nothing against Walmart. It's just I live in the middle of a city. We don't have a Walmart.
Right.
So that's not really a principled stand. But when someone says, we want to pay you millions of dollars to help tell better stories about who we really are, and we say, keep your millions of dollars, we're not going to do that. Yeah, that does rise to the level of being a principal.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, too. We have 67 people working here in the shop. We have 13 more slots open. Everything we do here has to be organized around getting those people to come back up the elevator every day. And
right.
One way we get them to come back up the elevator, the snacks and the happy hours and the kombucha on tap and the wine on tap.
Yeah, there's kombucha on tap here, people.
It's, and wine on tap, which I feel pretty good about.
Pretty amazing.
That's all nonsense. What they really want is to work at a place where they feel like they're doing something meaningful and that they have a role in contributing to it. And it's incumbent upon us, if we get to serve as their employer, that we do everything to keep them coming back up.
That's great. So I think we can diverge a little bit from talking shop, but we met for the first time through Scott, who was on the show last year, but it turns out we have other mutual friends through the watch world. So our friend Jacek, who we just had breakfast with, got you down the vintage Rolex rabbit hole quite a while ago, right?
He put a hook in me, and it's been there for a really long time.
That's what a good watch dealer does.
Very much a dealer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you end up a vintage Rolex collector?
I first got into Rolex because I just like the classic nature of Rolex. Rolex obviously means so much in the world of horology. I think I was telling you this morning that I bought my first ever Rolex at a Benbridge jewelers at Stonestown Galleria out in the really foggy part of San Francisco.
Okay.
And it was a sub, no date, because I couldn't afford the date. I think it was $3,800.
Back when you could walk into a jeweler and buy a no date sub.
Back when you could walk into a jeweler and buy a steel sport watch from Rolex.
Yeah.
You know, like this was a thing. And then they were just sitting there and loved it. And then decided later that I needed something a little more special. So a couple years later, that got traded in against a Kermit because I liked the anniversary and I liked the green insert.
Yeah.
And then I had that for a while. And then, I don't know, I think I went through a period where I had a really bad fever or something. At one point, I bought a beautiful but ultimately regrettable Panerai.
Okay.
It had a historical back, so it was a nice titanium watch. You could see all the inner workings. But, you know, the whole cigar aficionado nature of Panerai is something I really struggle with.
Okay.
And then one day I was sitting around and I had a couple watches that I was just like, why do I have these? I had one of the big Bell & Ross BR92s and I had this Panerai and I just would not wear them. And I said, I got to get rid of these things. And I did. And then Jacek turned them into Rolexes. And that started me down the path of starting to get into the 5513s and the 1680s and the 1675s and my forever watch, which I wear every day, which we were staring at this morning at breakfast. So Jacek, once you go into his environment and you get to know him a little bit, it's a very welcoming place to spend a fair amount of time and a fair amount of money.
Oh yeah.
And just love Jacek. He's one of my dear friends now.
That's great. And so can you describe the watch you're wearing on your wrist?
Yeah, I'll do it to the best of my ability. I'm outclassed by you and your listenership. But this watch, I named it Sexual Chocolate.
That's fitting.
Yeah. Well, to take a look at it too, you get a sense of it. It's a Meters first, red sub, a 1680, that's tropical. But you can't always pick up on just how tropical it is, because the insert itself has faded to this sort of chocolatey brown, and it's really uniform. That the insert's gone from black to pure brown and a little bit of red in the brown. So it's really unique in that way. And I just love that it's meters first. And it's just my companion. I've had it for a decade now. It's 50 years old this year. It's a 1969.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a year younger than me. So I think this is going to be the one I'm wearing when they put me in the casket.
That's a good one to have forever.
Yeah. It's my forever watch.
Yeah. You had a Blueberry GMT before that, right?
Yeah, I also had alongside this 1975 radial dialed 1675 okay. Blueberry.
Yeah, that's also a pretty nerdy watch. Both of those are both kind of like insidery kind of watches.
Yeah, Jacek's wife, Christina, was wearing a Blueberry okay. repeatedly, and I kept trying to buy it off her wrist.
Okay.
And she repeatedly said no. And Jacek found me a version I was happy with, and I had that for okay. a while. But to be honest, I just stopped wearing it.
Okay.
And I ultimately decided after sat in my house in a safe for a year that I would just let Jacek put it back out into the wild. I thought that was better to set yeah. it free. Because I'll be honest, I wear my Apple Watch Series 4 all weekend.
Okay. That was going to be my next question. I know you're an Apple Watch guy too.
I've had all versions. I mean, I'm into the quantified self. I really do want to know my VO2 max score. And I mean, I went from having an Apple Watch as a novelty in the early days, but I think Apple has this tendency by the fourth version of something to really get it right.
Yeah.
The iPhone 4 was really, really right. That was when the product really became what it is today mm-hmm. in a meaningful way. And I think the Apple Watch Series 4 did the same thing with the yeah. bigger battery, the bigger screen, and the more advanced telemetry around everything you're yeah. doing.
I would agree.
Yeah. So I literally sometimes stand in front of my dresser in the morning with a watch in each hand, and one's just an Apple Watch Series 4, just a stainless steel one, and the other one's my beautiful forever Rolex. And there are a number of days where the Apple Watch Series 4 wins out.
That's fine. I mean, some days it's the right choice, right?
I think so.
Have you ever worn both? I can tell from the laugh. I now know what the answer is.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I had done a Peloton at home in the morning and wanted more credit for the day. I was on a streak of closing all three rings, and mm-hmm. I wanted to go a week closing okay. all three rings for seven straight days. And I believe it was a Friday. I had done a Peloton, and I'm like, well, if I wear this watch today, I'll get there. But then I realized I had lunch with people that were interesting and interested around watches. So I figured if I walked to the train and walked to lunch and did all the things I did, I was going to get there. But I couldn't not wear the Rolex, and I couldn't just throw it in my bag. So I went all the way to the point of using the watch app on the phone to switch the orientation to my right wrist.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. So you committed.
Yeah, I don't half measure is not my thing. So I actually put it on my other wrist, and I wore two watches that day. Okay. And then I took the Apple Watch off at lunch for a brief period and then put it right back on when I left the restaurant. And I'm not proud.
That's okay. You're allowed.
No, it happened. I double watched.
So beyond watches, you're a bit of a collector in general, right? You've got that bone in your body?
Yeah. Yeah. Vintage stereo gear and records and wine take up a lot of my energy and most of my disposable income.
there's a record set up here at the office, right? I think we can see it through the window there.
Yeah, it's got some of the hand-me-down gear, you know, so it's just a little Rotel integrated amplifier and a Marantz turntable that was actually built by Clear Audio in Germany. So it was this great Marantz deck that's got this sort of ceramic acrylic plinth and then an offboard motor that is really a beautiful deck. It's like a Clear Audio Emotion that they allowed to be branded by Marantz. So it was my first good turntable.
Okay.
And I just sort of bring in old equipment and have the equipment in the office that I've, you know, gone through my system at home. So like having records in the office, I like the intentionality mm-hmm. of listening to records. It's not unlimited.
Yeah.
It does require physical action. You do have to flip it. You do have to clean it. I think it engages you in the act and therefore in the music in a meaningful way.
So I would assume if you're deep into records, you're a believer in listening to a record start to finish.
Yes. Yeah, I don't listen to greatest hits, you know, because they don't make any sense. And not everything has to be a concept record, you know. Not everything is OK Computer. And I love making playlists, right? So I contain multitudes. But when you want to have the experience and you have your original 1966 pressing of Blonde on Blonde, you're going to play Blonde on Blonde all the way through because that's the way you do it. It's just good taste. It's good. It's good manners.
I love that. It's just good taste. Like it's just what you do.
It's just what you do.
Yeah. What are a couple records? I won't make you give us a full laundry list, but what are a couple records you'd recommend people, whether it's on vinyl or whether they go onto Spotify or Apple Music? What are a couple records you think people should listen to start to finish if they haven't recently?
Good one. I think for anybody who likes quality recording and quality engineering and records that are just really well put together, because there is a material difference. Any of the run of Talking Heads records from the late 70s up into the early 80s is something where you're going to be in a good place, whether it's Fear of Music or even Little Creatures. Those are ones that you're really going to enjoy because David Byrne is such a genius. He's a visual genius. He's a songwriting genius. He's a performing genius. But he also is an amazing guitar player and had those records engineered and produced absolutely beautifully. I keep getting further into a collaborator with David Byrne's. I spend a lot of time with Brian Eno and especially his ambient works. So I have three different vinyl versions of his 1975 classic Ambient One, Music for Airports.
Love that record so much.
I love it so much.
Oh, it's so good.
And it sounds so much better on vinyl.
I don't think I've ever heard it on vinyl.
Well, you can in just a minute because it's sitting right in front of the stack right now. not my best turntable setup, but that's one I would absolutely do that with. Records to listen to all the way through. I'm completely unapologetic Radiohead nut.
Okay.
And I think they're great. Underappreciated album is Hail to the Thief.
Yeah.
The way it fell between Kid A and Amnesiac before they transitioned into In Rainbows. All of those great records, but I think Hail to the Thief sometimes gets left behind in that argument. And Hail to the Thief as a cohesive piece of music has so much of what Radiohead is good at all in one record, from the weird stuff to the guitar hero stuff all the way through dystopian ideas. It's really one that I spend a lot of time with. And then I like going back to some of the greats. If you've never listened to Bill Evans' trio, Sunday at the Village Vanguard on vinyl, you've never heard it. And you're hearing everything that went on. That was a crappy recording on a Sunday at the Vanguard. There's even a dropout in the first track on the record. You know, that's there because it dropped out. It's an external mic'd recording. You can hear people laughing. You can hear glasses clinking. It's one of the most engrossing pieces of music I've ever heard in my life, and I'll always go back to it.
That's amazing.
Oh, it's such a good one.
I'll have to give that a listen. I don't think I've ever heard that on vinyl.
Oh, yeah.
I can tell from the smile on your face that I'm not going to regret that.
Every time I walk by the Village Vanguard, I just, you know, sort of silently, you know, give a little nod and a bow for what they were able to do there.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, that record was so perfect, and then Scott LaFaro, the bassist, one of the greatest bassists who ever lived, died 2 weeks later in a car accident in upstate New York. And, you know, so that was the last document of that trio performing at that level. It makes the thing that much more special.
Amazing. You said you're also a wine guy?
I'm a wine guy. That's been since I was in my early 20s. So
okay.
I've had some bottles I've had for 20 years now.
What kind of wines are you into?
Well, that's an interesting thing because everybody I know who's into wine has seen their palate evolve. And it does create kind of a situation where you've been collecting a style of wine and then your palate evolves and all of a sudden you're holding on to a bunch of inventory. So I started early days with Rhone varietals, really got into both North and South Rhone, a lot of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, a lot of Vacheron, Gigondas, Saint-Joseph, the ultimate Côte Rôti. And then some American styles because there was sort of a Rhone revolution that happened here. But as my palate has evolved, you know, I got into more Burgundies, white and red. I'm still terrified of Burgundy, the region, because it will break your heart. You know, the bottle, you finally find the bottle that you were looking for. And if it's from the right village in the right year and was stored properly and everything else, it still might be, you know, pre-oxidated, and it still might be something that just went wrong. But when it sings, it's amazing. Today, I'm spending most of my time and energy and money on Italian wine. Okay. Classic expressions of Sangiovese from some of the great producers. Not always things like Brunello di Montalcino, also Rosso di Montalcino and simple Chianti, which is pure Sangiovese. But I think my rosebud wine has become various expressions of Nebbiolo. So everything from Piemonte and some of the truly great producers, you know, both the Mascarellos, Giuseppe and Bartolo, and getting into Rinaldi and all of the great producers of Barolo and Barbaresco and Barbera and everything else that goes on there. So it's just a really rich ground for that. That said, my wife and I have a home in Sonoma, and there's this great new generation of European-centric, entirely natural winemakers making some incredible things happen in California. I can't be bothered with California Cabernet for the most part. I get why people like it. It's just not for me. There are a few producers in Napa that make wines that I like Kathy Corison makes restrained, beautiful Cabernets that seem like they were from 30 years ago. But the big sort of 16% alcohol, sweet, glycerin-like Cabernets,
yeah,
can't do it. But there's some weird, weird stuff happening in California, and I absolutely love those producers that, you know, are very into natural, organic, biodynamic winemaking methods with Europe as a reference point. Really fresh, vibrant, bright wines. If I were to sum it all up, and I've been talking too long about it, when I was a kid, I looked for wines that were powerful. But now I look for wines that are beautiful. And I think that's the easiest way to sum up the whole thing.
I like that. What is it about collecting, whether it's wine or records or audio equipment or watches? What is it about collecting that you like? Because you're obviously somebody who likes that kind of pursuit and that passion of collecting.
Yeah, I clearly am. I'm something of a completist. I figure out something that I like, and then I'm not able to relax until I've plundered it. Whether that was how I got into Bob Dylan, and then needed to know every phase of what he was doing and what he was thinking and where it came from, so I understood why Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid was totally different from Blood on the Tracks, or whether it was Pavement at an earlier time and needed to know exactly how and why that went down. Same thing goes with wine. I have an experience that someone turns me on to with a wine, and next thing you know, I'm reading a 1,200-page book on the methods of that region. I think I feel empowered by knowledge, and then I think I have just a typical obsessive's tendency toward, I wouldn't say acquisition, I have an obsessive's tendency toward wanting to know more and wanting to see how far this thing goes. And I've certainly done that with a few different things in my life. There's no question about it.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, I know you were recording this at your office, and you have a full day of stuff to get into here. But thanks so much for making the time, and it's good to see you as always.
It's really great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Let's go listen to some Brian Eno.
Yeah, let's go do that. We'll link everything up in the notes so people can then go give it a listen too.
Sounds good.
And to close things out, we've got Cara and Jack doing the first ever Rorjack test.
All right, what are we doing here today?
Well, Cara, we thought we'd do something a little different today. So what we're going to do is something in the nature of a psychiatric test, shall we say. you know, there's the Rorschach inkblot test, and there's also a free association test, much used and revered by Freudian psychoanalysts. And the idea basically is that you get a sense of someone's inner life, so to speak, by throwing words at them and hearing their completely unscripted and spontaneous response.
What did I sign myself up for? Yeah. I hope I don't say anything weird.
Now, you know, Cara, the great thing about a free association test is it really leaves you off the hook. You don't have to create anything. It doesn't require any effort. It
merely free thinking.
That's right. It merely All requires right. you to be completely spontaneous, which I know is a...
Should we take some deep breaths?
Yes, together. Inhale. Exhale.
I'm trying not to breathe into the mic because I don't want to freak our listeners out.
Also, I think we may have deafened our producer. All right. Shall we jump right into it?
All right, let's do it.
All right, Paul Newman.
Daytona.
Well, I guess there's no real surprise there. Doesn't reveal anything about your psychological depths.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, could there have been any other reaction in the World Horological?
No.
No.
I think it's just Daytona. And honestly, that would have been my reaction if someone had just said that to her, like any, even if we weren't talking about watches, I think that that would be my reaction, which says a lot about the level that I'm in.
Fotina.
Omega.
Ooh. Connect the dots there for us?
I think they were kind of the first in my mind to create watches with Fotina that really, even though they weren't, I'm pretty sure, I think there were some before that, but they were kind of the first mainstream manufacturer to release watches with Fotina when they did the trilogy back in 2017, I believe.
That's an excellent question, though. What was actually the very first Fotina watch?
All I know is Fotina was coined on Friday Live. Ba-dum-tsh.
Baselworld Hall 1.
Death.
Stephen J. Pulverant.
Neat.
That was neat. That was neat with an N, right?
Yes.
Okay, just I don't want anyone.
N-E-A-T. N-E-A-T, neat.
Yeah, good, good. I don't think that we really need to connect the dots.
No, I think we're all familiar.
I mean, he's a very neat, tidy, organized person.
The only, sure is.
The only person at Hodinkee who keeps canned air in his desk to blow crumbs out of his keyboard.
He also has little pads to put, like, his mouse on, his keyboard, his watch, his phone.
Geneva.
Switzerland. It's not that exciting. It's
not really a stretch.
Yeah.
That's okay, though. That's okay, though. We're looking for the authentic.
Yeah.
Vaping.
Illegal? Even though it's not?
Although it's looking less and less attractive with every passing day.
Sure is. I mean, yeah. As a former, well, I won't even get into it.
All right.
Cut that part out, Gray.
Moving with discreet haste to the next word.
Yes, please.
Wegmans.
Sandwiches.
Oh, well, again, seems like a logical.
Yeah, they've got good sandwiches.
Where's the closest Wegmans to New York?
In New Jersey.
Are you ever thinking about Wegmans and watches at the same time?
I've had conversations where both have been involved, yes.
So would you say there's a common enthusiast base?
I think if you like nice things, you like Wegmans. And I didn't grow up with Wegmans. That's like a New England thing. So my late in life discovery, I will say, has been very enjoyable. I think they've got great products. The sandwiches are good. The pre-made food is good.
Not unlike discovering watches a little bit
it's
later.
It's very similar, I would say.
There you go. Moon signs.
Taurus.
What do we mean by moon signs?
Moon signs, I think, is astrology, right?
That was what my take was.
Yeah, so your moon sign is, so you have three signs. You have your sign, like your regular sign.
You have your sun sign.
Which is sun sign, which yes. I'm a Taurus.
Yes.
And then you have your moon sign, which is what you are behind closed doors. Mine's a Libra. Mm-hmm. And then you have your outward, I think your sun sign, which is your outward facing sign, which I'm a Cancer.
So there's the sun sign, which is the sign of the zodiac that the sun was in when you were born. Moon sign, which is the sign of the zodiac the moon was in when
yes.
you were born. And there's your rising sign, which is the sign that was, I believe it's defined as rising above the horizon at the time of your birth.
Oh no, maybe my rising sign is Cancer. Whatever I present to the world, I'm a Cancer, but I'm a Taurus.
Ooh. Princess Diana.
Oh, legend.
Ooh. You think so?
Yes. I was like obsessed with her when I was younger.
Really?
Yeah. Obsessed? I was like a kid. Well, I just thought she was like magic. I just thought she was like so beautiful, like so cool. She was a princess.
She was. She was.
She was a people. I was very, yes.
Is there a connection of Princess Diana to the watch world? I believe she may have given someone a watch that they still wear.
Did she give Prince Charles a watch or did she give Prince William a watch?
Not Prince Charles. I think Prince William.
Maybe. I didn't know that, but I'll have to look into it.
Work lunch.
Salad. Even though I don't eat salads very often.
I feel like you're going through a bit of a salad phase.
I am, because, you know, I'm getting older and like food energy, food like affects your energy. And when I have a sandwich or something for lunch, yeah. I get really tired.
Yeah. And then you can't content.
Exactly. So salads it is.
It's salads help you think about watches in the afternoon.
Yes.
Through the long,
they keep me going.
Through the long, arduous afternoons of thinking about watches.
I know, it's hard to keep track of everything.
It is. Do you think the increased amount of roughage helps clear the mind?
No, we don't think we need to get into that online.
All right. Tattoos.
I have one.
All right. Is it of a watch?
No.
Is it of Paul Newman?
No.
Is it of Stephen J. Pulverint?
No, but these are all great ideas.
Do you think you and Stephen J. Pulverint should get matching portrait tattoos?
No, but I have for the longest time tried to convince Stevie to get a tattoo. Because of the epic meltdown that would happen after he got a tattoo. Because he's so neat, as we discussed earlier, that I think the second he got a tattoo, he would just freak out because he couldn't wash it off.
Yeah, it's harder to walk back a tattoo than it is some
sure
other decisions.
Sure is.
I don't know what this next one means, so you're going to have to clear that up. Lisa Vanderpump.
She's pretty epic.
Is she?
That's the word I would use. I mean, she's fallen out of favor with a lot of people lately because she spread a lot of gossip.
Who is this
did
person?
You guys circulate this internally to get people to control?
Listen, I'm seeing that this was put together by your colleagues, not including me. So
yeah, seriously. No, she's one of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. No mas. She quit.
Oh.
She quit to the press before she told Andy Bravo.
Any connection to the watch world other than that Stephen J. Pulverint, whose name is coming up a lot, is a reality TV fanatic?
No. She wears like a lot of bling, though.
No.
Her husband wears a Hublot, I think.
All right, quartz.
Watches, which is sad. Because at first it was watches, and then I immediately thought of rose quartz, which is a healing stone.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
But not found in watches.
I don't think so. Actually, no, I think not necessarily rose quartz, but quartz, the crystal, is found in watches.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all I got.
Odell Beckham.
Well, too much time has passed.
David Beckham.
Football player, but footballer. He's a soccer player.
That's true.
But I was saying, I think I said football by accident.
No, it's a...
Because I was doing the English thing.
Yes.
I was trying to be English.
Were you?
We'll go with that.
All right. Isn't he an ambassador for a certain brand?
Tuda.
Indeed.
Tuda.
Double wristing.
Uh-huh. Huh?
Double wristing?
Huh?
Wearing a watch on... wearing one.
That's what... Huh? I don't get it.
Is it anything that you would ever do?
I don't think so.
What do you think of the fact that I do it?
I think it's okay that you do it.
But you
you're the exception to almost every rule.
Thank you for that, I think. Do you think it's an absurdity?
No. I think it makes sense when you have an Apple Watch and another watch. Because one's tracking for health and one's tracking time.
What did you think of Nicholas G. Hayek's habit of wearing 6 watches on each wrist?
I think it's a little excessive.
On the other hand, so was Nicholas G. Hayek.
There you go.
He was larger than life in every respect.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I don't think you need 6 watches on one wrist.
Pizza.
Yum.
I don't think we need to dig any deeper than that. New York.
Where I live. Said unenthusiastically.
I was looking for something like center of the watch universe so as to spark debate.
Okay, center of the universe. Go.
Los Angeles.
Ooh, sunny.
Also a center of the watch universe?
I think it's a popular place for watches, yes.
How would you describe that? How would you characterize, or can you characterize, the difference between New York watch culture and LA watch culture?
I see more watches when I'm in LA.
Uh-huh.
But it's... very repetitive. So it's a lot of the same stuff, which I think is fine. That's just kind of it's a trend. It's kind of what happens.
I'm almost never out there myself, in spite of the fact that I have family out there. What do you see a lot of?
I see a lot of Nautiluses. I see a lot of APs. I see a lot of bracelet watches. You know, it's kind of like Rolex AP and the 5711 are like the go-tos.
Is that significantly different than what you feel like you see in New York?
In New York, I think you get a broader range of like niche vintage pieces to Submariners a little bit more. So
I feel like every time we do a Hodinkee meetup, there's always a good 10% of the folks that show up have something quirky and idiosyncratic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's kind of speaks to the culture of the
Would you say Los Angeles watch culture is a little bit more... I don't want to say not predictable, but maybe more outward looking, more a little bit more status aware.
Yeah, maybe
less insidery.
Yeah, I mean it's a little more Hollywood, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in just like that's the environment in and which they live.
Yeah, and no surprise there, Hollywood being in Los Angeles.
Exactly.
GPHG.
Never been.
Want to go?
I'm okay.
Any interest?
I'm all good.
Would you like to be on the jury some year?
Maybe.
Have you seen anything on the lists this year that really jumped out at you?
No, I'll have to revisit the list. I think I'd be a pretty cutthroat juror, though.
I suspect you would be. What do you think of the whole GPHG as a sort of a general enterprise?
I think it's great, but I think that they should do it with all watches. I don't think that you should have to, everyone pays to be on there.
Yeah.
So I think it should be free. So you can actually vote for watches that don't necessarily pay to, you know what I mean? I think it would give a lot more. Well,
the entry fee is fairly nominal. The real, the biggest issue with the GPHG, and I say this as a judge for the last 3 years, is that watches have to be submitted because the organization wants judges to be able to actually see them in person and handle them. And it's not always, possible to do that.
Right. So
copycat.
I don't know.
Let's try again. Clear your mind. Clear your mind, Cara Parrott. Emptiness. Emptiness. Copycat.
I keep picturing Felix the cat. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Are you familiar with Felix the cat wall clocks?
Yeah. That's what I'm kind of picturing.
Yeah. Yep. I actually, some people have wonderful clock collections. We know a couple of people who own Atmos clocks, which are wonderful things to have in your home. In my kitchen, there is, in fact, exactly that clock.
A Felix cat?
Yeah, with the eyes that go back and forth.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah. I like
love those ever since I was a kid.
I want a life-size Swatch clock in this office.
I feel like you could make that
happen. What I'm talking about, the jelly clocks.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are so good.
Platinum.
Cold.
Gold.
Warm.
Stainless steel.
Also cold.
$10 million.
A lot.
I like how much ground we've covered in the last 72 seconds.
Rapid fire.
Indeed. Friday Live.
Fun.
Do you miss it?
Bring it back.
The problem is...
No, there's no problems. I don't see problems. I see solutions.
Well, there's a you see opportunities.
Yeah,
Where other people see problems, you see opportunities.
Exactly.
I wonder how our esteemed producer, Mr. Grayson Korhonen, who had
Gray,
to do
what do you think about it?
Well, I have muted you guys.
Bring it back. Bring it back.
Yeah, it was a bit of a heavy lift.
It sure was.
From a technical perspective.
And from an emotional one on our side.
Yeah, yeah. We would often cry after Friday Live. It was cathartic.
Or have a beer.
Yeah. Or do,
and then
do
the work
both.
Was over.
Yeah. Or do both at the same time. The other problem with Friday Live is that we would do it Friday afternoon and then we wouldn't feel like working.
No, there'd be no work done after that.
Which was,
detrimental to the growth of the company. There's probably a correlation between the two.
It might well be. Did Hodinkee really start to take off when we killed Friday Live?
Maybe.
Hodinkee Radio.
Fun.
Yes.
Also fun.
And sustainable.
And sustainable. Slightly lighter lift.
Case back engravings.
I like them.
Do you have a favorite?
I really like when you come across old watches or vintage ones that have Christmas messages or love messages from the 30s and 40s. I always think that that's really nice to think about what that family was doing on Christmas Day.
Yeah, it's super charming. It just sort of brings you back in time a little bit, right?
Yeah.
What do you have a favorite over the years that's kind of stuck out in your mind? Maybe from something you saw while you were in the auction world?
Well, Cartier used to do this thing where you could do these little envelope shaped shutter watches.
And, oh, I love those.
And you could get them personalized with your name and your address on them.
On the shutter.
On the shutter.
That's cool.
So it looked like an, had little postage, little stamp. So I always thought those were really darling. But just the Christmas kind of messages I always thought were really sweet.
Man, that is such a Cartier thing, isn't it?
I know. It's the best.
Yeah. It's just it's kind of them at their best.
Yeah.
Adam Scott.
Golf.
And...
And former Hodinkee Radio guest.
Oh, yes. There you go.
And very nice guy, actually.
Orel Box.
And I love Orel. I'm actually fascinated by Orel.
That's not a one-word answer.
He's very intense when you first meet him.
He is a very intense.
But I find his whole career path fascinating. What he's been able to do for the auction world with watches is really something else.
He has been able to bring... we as watch enthusiasts feel there's something intrinsically exciting about watches. But certainly a lot of the time the broader world does not agree.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things Aurel has succeeded in doing as a great watch enthusiast and also a fantastic communicator is actually get that excitement out into the world.
Yeah. No, it's true. He's one of the most charismatic auctioneers I've ever seen. And he gets people to bid.
Jean-Claude Beaver.
Amazing.
Yes.
Happy birthday.
Oh, yes.
It was his birthday a few days ago, I think.
Philippe Dufour.
Ledge.
Yes, he is.
Yes. Yes, he is.
Advice.
I give a lot of advice.
Yeah, do you?
Unwarranted.
What's the best and the worst advice in retrospect you've ever given anyone?
Well, I never tell people to. I always say never buy a watch as an investment because you just don't know if you're going to get the return on it. Yeah. And you should buy something because you enjoy it or you like it or it really kind of speaks to you. And if it goes up, great. If it doesn't, you can't be mad about it.
I feel like I was telling people that they shouldn't consider vintage Rolex Submariners as an investment like 20 years ago.
Yeah. LOL.
So, sorry about that.
Everybody. Yeah.
Especially me. All right. Ready?
Yeah.
Last one. Mind clear. No undulations in consciousness whatsoever. Remind. The mind gives rise to no form.
Okay, my eyes are closed.
Form gives rise to no mind. Form is emptiness.
Are you hypnotizing me?
Emptiness is form. Vintage.
Watches.
Oh.
I know, so boring. You said think of the first word that came to mind.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, what else were you going to say? Especially in this context.
Cool. Vintage is cool.
It is now.
It is now.
Was it always?
I don't know. Well, in my lifetime in this industry, yes, it was always desirable.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us in this utterly transparent, completely unscripted trip
totally.
Inside the mind of Cara Barrett.
Yeah, the Rorschach test.
Cara, you've been a great sport. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week's episode was recorded at the Mondrian Hotel in Los Angeles, California, Godfrey Dadich Partners headquarters in San Francisco, California, and at Hodinkee HQ in New York, New York. It was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.